It's Thursday, September 24th. They killed Breonna Taylor, but according to prosecutors, that wasn't a crime. We start here.
I'm very, very sad.
Activists wanted charges against police, but not these ones.
Breonna Taylor is not even mentioned.
Protesters have poured into the streets in Louisville, Kentucky. We'll take you to the scene. Ruth Bader Ginsburg's legacy stands on the steps of the Supreme Court to greet her.
They were lined up across the court plaza all the way up the steps by the dozens.
But the remembrances are continuing far outside Washington. Our reporter goes on a road trip to talk to voters, and Dr. Fauci claps back.
You were not listening.
Experts have new warnings for Congress, but they're still trying to hammer home the old ones. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. There are plenty of examples of people of color in this country being killed by police in plain sight. Black Americans have long pointed to Eric Garner, Philando Castile, Tamir Rice, and now George Floyd as reasons for keeping their guard up in public. Breonna Taylor is different because the death of Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky, has now come to represent someone who wasn't even safe in her own home, sleeping in her bed.
A 26-year-old black woman killed in her apartment by Louisville Metro Police during the botched execution of a no-knock search warrant in March.
The city had already expressed remorse and reached a settlement agreement with her family, including money and police reforms. But the officers themselves, who shot into Taylor's home, had not yet been charged with a crime.
Okay, we are on the record to receive the report of the grand jury for September 23rd, 2020.
Well, yesterday, prosecutors announced that after presenting the facts to a grand jury, they had a decision.
In the matter of Commonwealth of Kentucky versus Brett Hankison, the Jefferson County grand jury charges as follows.
One officer would be charged, but not for murder. The others hadn't been charged with anything at all. And if potential charges were the big fire door on Louisville, keeping those glowing embers of anger in check, this gave those embers a rush of oxygen. And officials immediately worried that the city could burst into flames. Let's go to ABC's Alex Perez. He joins us from Louisville, Kentucky. Alex, there were charges here, right? Why did activists and the Taylor family not think they were enough?
Well, let's take a step back here. The tension, the anxiety has been growing in the air here in Louisville for some 6 months now, since Breonna Taylor was killed.
The police department in Louisville is bracing for an announcement of the investigation by Kentucky's attorney general.
And it reached a fever pitch in the last couple of days as the city sort of warned everyone that this announcement was coming.
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us today.
So everyone was glued to their phones, glued to their computers, watching this announcement made by the attorney general in Frankfort, Kentucky. That's about 45 minutes away from Louisville.
There's nothing I can offer today to take away the grief and heartache this family is experiencing as a result of losing a child, a niece, a sister, and a friend. What I can provide today are the facts.
And what we learned is that the grand jury, after it was presented with evidence, decided to charge one of the three officers involved.
The grand jury voted to return an indictment against Detective Hankison for three counts of wanton endangerment.
Charge him with three counts of wanton endangerment for firing his weapon in that apartment complex where she was killed and endangering other residents of that apartment complex.
So you're saying he's not being charged for shooting at Breonna Taylor. He's being charged for shooting into, like, her neighbor's homes.
Into endangering the other people who live in that apartment complex. And in those charges, Breonna Taylor is not even mentioned.
According to Kentucky law, the use of force by Mattingly and Cosgrove was justified to protect themselves. This justification bars us from pursuing criminal charges in Miss Breonna Taylor's death.
And that's really what has many protesters in disbelief, that none of these charges actually had anything to do with Breonna Taylor herself or with her death.
The decision by the grand jury, your reaction?
My reaction, I am quite devastated, to say at the very least. Like, I'm very, very sad. Very, very mad.
I mean, when this announcement was made, there were protesters who were literally crying.
I feel like it could have been me. Sorry. Breonna Taylor was 26 when she was killed in her apartment, and I was also 26 at the time. So then, like, for me to turn 27 and for her to not turn 27, like, it's kind of wild. Like,
it was difficult for a lot of people. I talked to some people on the ground.
At the end of the day, the other two police officers that were involved in this are going to be able to go home and sleep in their own beds. And Breonna's mom's not going to be able to hug her daughter ever again. Kenny Walker's never going to be able to see his girlfriend again.
Many of them are disheartened. They see this decision as much more than just Breonna Taylor. They see it as a bigger part of the Black Lives Matter movement.
Not only ending no-knock warrants, but mandating that officers have their body cameras on when they issue a warrant before and afterwards.
But with that said, a lot of the people I talk to say, you know, they're not giving up. They still believe in the movement. They still believe that things here and across the country can change, and they're going to continue working on that.
Well, and state officials had really been prepping for potential violence if this exact scenario happened. We're still getting a sense of exactly all the things that unfold on a night like we just saw. But in the immediate aftermath, I mean, what has the vibe in the city been like?
Yeah, you know, I mean, the air was tense, and part of the tension in the air had to do with authorities preemptively seeming to prepare for the worst.
My third executive order sets a countywide 72-hour curfew from 9 p.m. to 6:30 a.m. beginning tonight.
Downtown area here in Louisville, some 25 blocks completely barricaded, closed to vehicular traffic for 2 days. Mm. Every business downtown completely boarded up. But in the immediate aftermath of that decision, what we saw was marchers taking to the streets, mostly peacefully. We did see there are some garbage cans that protesters lit on fire.
They are about to disperse chemical agents, y'all.
And there were some what looked like heated clashes with police officers.
He's touching him! Stop! He's bleeding! He's bleeding! Ah, he's bleeding!
But authorities are hoping that the decisions they made before all of this, calling in 500 National Guardsmen, canceling vacation days and days off for police officers so they have extra officers. They're hoping that those decisions pay off in the long run as things move forward here.
Right there, officer down, right there. Officer down. Yes.
And we actually got word overnight that two officers were shot in an incident. It wasn't immediately clear how related to the protest this was, but there's a suspect in custody. There are clearly concerns here, Alex. So as far as charges go, just so we're clear, is this the end of it, or could there still be new charges down the line?
The criminal investigation at this point involving those three officers, according to the attorney general, seems to be completed.
We know that y'all was going to do this. We know Daniel's not going to do nothing. We know that.
But there is a federal civil rights investigation that's still ongoing, and authorities there are working to see if Breonna Taylor's civil rights were violated when this warrant was executed back in March of this year. And part of that involves, you know, investigating the officers that were responsible for issuing that warrant and how exactly it was carried out. So the federal civil rights investigation is not entirely over just yet, but it appears a criminal investigation is over and not what exactly protesters were looking for.
All right, Alex Perez reporting from Louisville, Kentucky. Alex, we'll check in with you later. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, it's not just Washington marking the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Our reporter has been talking to voters in swing states. Back in a bit.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg became a Supreme Court justice 27 years ago. Yesterday, she arrived at the court one last time as her casket was carried up the steps so Americans could pay their respects. ABC senior Washington reporter Devin Dwyer covers the Supreme Court. He's spoken to Justice Ginsburg in the past. And Devin, you were right there for the procession as well, right? What was it like there?
Brett, it was such a moving scene, especially to see those legions of young, current, and former law clerks, some not so young now, that worked with her on the bench in her 27 years. They were lined up across the court plaza all the way up the steps by the dozens.
Those are Supreme Court police actually carrying the casket, her clerks lining the way.
It was so powerful to see, and a really poignant reminder that even though Justice Ginsburg has left us, her legacy lives on in so many young lawyers.
The justices behind her. Chief Justice John Roberts will speak.
Justice Ginsburg's life was one of the many versions of the American dream.
And I was really struck yesterday by Chief Justice John Roberts' brief eulogy up in the Great Hall of the Supreme Court.
She was not an opera star, but she found her stage right behind me in our courtroom. There she won famous victories that helped move our nation closer to equal justice under law, to the extent that women are now a majority in law schools, not simply a handful.
He called Justice Ginsburg someone who modeled humility to everyone.
Many of you have seen the famous picture of Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg riding atop an elephant in India.
Even in spite of her rock star status, she was humble. She was focused on the law. I heard that from her in my meeting with her, which was such an honor to have just a year ago.
And in the photograph, she is riding with a dear friend. A friend with totally divergent views. There is no indication in the photo that either was poised to push the other off.
But so many Americans today remembering that legacy, as Justice Roberts put it, 438 legal opinions, occurrences, and dissents that will live on and will shape the future of the court long after she's gone, Brad.
Well, so as people in Washington took this in, how has the rest of America responded? Are you getting a sense?
I was struck this week, Brad, taking a trip to Minnesota where we were doing some reporting in the suburbs around Minneapolis, St. Paul, about just how much her death has impacted women, even in the middle of the country, hundreds of miles away.
What did you think Friday night when you heard the news about Ruth
Bader Ginsburg? Oh, I cried.
You cried?
Yeah.
Just the mention of Ginsburg's name drew tears.
I'm almost crying now.
was just awful. And then to think people don't understand, too, that these general elections are important for the whole future of our Supreme Court.
And this is days after she had passed Brad. Clearly, she was someone that Americans on both sides of the political aisle respected.
I mean, they always talk about liberal or conservative judges. But to me, she was just an outstanding member of the Supreme Court.
We were in the suburbs, in fact, talked to one woman who was a devout Catholic, someone who opposes abortion. And I said, well, what do you think about Justice Ginsburg? She says she was a fantastic and superb member of the Supreme Court, a pioneer for women. I will miss her.
That's kind of interesting, Devin. I would assume the farther away you get from Washington or from New York, where she's from, you know, the less people would have an emotional attachment to her as a person. They just want to be talking about, you know, the open seat, what affects the court.
Well, and quite the contrary, Brad. In fact, I found that the debate over Justice Ginsburg's seat hasn't quite sunk in yet.
The president is obligated to put up a nomination. So I do believe he should.
The ramifications of a court balance of power that will be potentially be changed now for generations haven't really yet been felt by most everyday Americans, at least the ones that I met.
It's a turbulent time, and I think we should just let the election happen and get that out of the way.
You know, there was a real weariness about what's in store, but for at least these first few hours and days after her death, a true, genuine, and remarkable admiration of someone who is an American icon.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg will continue to lie in repose at the court today. Her casket will actually move tomorrow to the Capitol, where she'll be lying in state. Devin Dwyer talking to voters, as always. Thanks for the perspective, Devin.
Thanks, Brett.
When the coronavirus pandemic began, the question from a lot of us was, okay, how many months before people can start resuming some sense of normalcy? Well, yesterday, the Metropolitan Opera in New York City announced they're canceling their next show and their entire next season, which goes through the spring of 2021.
Met officials said today that the painful decision to cancel the remainder of the season is based on advice from health officials.
Now, I don't know how upset you are about missing the opera, but this announcement happened to come the same day as experts arrived on Capitol Hill, emphatically telling members of Congress that COVID-19 will still be affecting your life this time next year. ABC senior congressional correspondent Mary Bruce joins us now from the Capitol. Mary, it makes a kind of intuitive sense that when a vaccine arrives, you think, boom, the problem goes away, get on with your life. And yet that is not the picture these doctors are painting. Why?
Yeah, do not put away your mask just yet. And don't, you know, think that you can all of a sudden be indoors chumming up close to people.
You are still going to have vulnerable people in the United States, which would require not only testing, contact tracing, but a implementation of the public health measures that we've been talking about all along.
As Anthony Fauci made very clear in this hearing yesterday, a vaccine, even when one is available, even when you have one, even when you get the booster shot that you might need to ensure that the vaccine works effectively, COVID isn't going away. It's not simply that easy.
But you're not going to completely eradicate or eliminate it, particularly if you have a vaccine that is even moderately effective, 75%.
So you're still going to have a large amount, likely, of vulnerable people in the population. And in order to protect them, that means that we all need to continue wearing those masks, likely socially distancing, still being aware of the way that we are interacting with this virus.
If we all wore a mask and we were smart about social distancing, as Dr. Fauci alluded to, this outbreak would really start to come to under control.
And Mary, it also seemed like Anthony Fauci was just kind of done with some of these senators.
Yeah, there was a very tense exchange between Anthony Fauci and Republican Senator Rand Paul, who has made Fauci a frequent target.
How can we possibly be jumping up and down and saying, oh, Governor Cuomo did a great job? He had the worst death rate in the world.
No, you misconstrued that, Senator, and you've done that repetitively in the past.
Rand Paul was still trying to undermine and discredit Dr. Fauci, questioning why it is that New York City has been able to beat back the virus.
They are looking at the guidelines that we have put together from the task force of the four or five things of masks, social distancing, outdoors more than indoors, avoiding crowds, and washing hands.
Or they've developed enough community immunity right. that they're no longer having the pandemic because they have enough immunity in New York City to actually stop.
I challenge that, Senator.
I'm afraid, please, sir,
I would like to be able to do this because this happens with Senator Rand all the time. You were not listening to what the director of the CDC said, that in New York, it's about 22%. If you believe 22% is herd immunity, I believe you're alone in that.
I think you have to remember that part of this hearing was for these public health officials to really convince the American public that they can trust them.
In the end, FDA will not authorize or approve a vaccine that we would not feel comfortable giving to our families.
Because as we have seen based on polling, a lot of Americans are increasingly skeptical of a vaccine. You have the president still out there sending mixed messages about the coronavirus.
Take your hat off to the young, because they have a hell of an immune system, but it affects virtually nobody. It's an amazing thing.
I do want to emphasize the shift in age in these case counts. The 18 to 25-year-olds currently make up over 26% of new infections and more than any other group.
And you have a lot of growing concern that the Trump administration is putting political pressure on scientists, that they're putting politics ahead of the science.
The FDA is reportedly considering stricter guidelines for the emergency authorization of a COVID vaccine. Are you okay with that?
Well, I tell you what, we're looking at that. That has to be approved by the White House. We may or may not approve it. That sounds like a political move.
Okay, so that's sort of the public information part. The other thing Congress is interested in, of course, is how their constituents are doing. And for a lot of people, that's money. That's economics. Where does another COVID relief bill stand? Like, is that done or is that happening in like a smaller fashion? What's the deal?
It is remarkable, but despite the frustration on both sides, despite the real pain being felt by millions of Americans, there is not a lot of urgency here on the Hill. And I think just let that sink in for a moment, right? We have 200,000 Americans now dead, millions unemployed, jobs lost, eviction notices going out, and Washington cannot get its act together.
The onus is on Nancy Pelosi. You know, we've come up in our number to $1.5 trillion.
Perfect, so it's $3.4 trillion. Remember, we've come down $1 trillion, and said we'd meet them in the middle.
And while there are plenty of ideas floating around, and there have been plenty of attempts to negotiate, for instance, you know, there's one bill floating around that does have a lot of bipartisan support. It's a Restaurants Act, which would provide $120 billion for the unique needs of restaurants. But even that doesn't seem to be able to get over some other hurdles here. Washington simply cannot get together on a solution. And I don't think that Americans should be looking to Washington for any kind of relief, certainly not before the election.
Which is just so wild when you talk about, like you mentioned restaurants, anyone who works in nightlife, anyone who works in the arts, anyone who works in travel, these are industries where people have been hurting badly. And now if they're being told, hey, like people are still going to be wearing masks and stuff at your nightclub in 2021, just a world of hurt without really a lot of help in sight. Mary Bruce at the Capitol. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
And one last thing. The scariest thing this Halloween could be the screaming itself.
Bless you.
The CDC has now put out guidance for all 50 states on how to protect your community during Halloween. Some of these steps are things we've talked about before. Door-to-door trick-or-treating is high risk. So is trunk-or-treating. Anything really where you're standing close to lots of different people, whether in a group or one at a time. But what they really wanted to drive home here is that this virus spreads from little particles in your mouth. And the louder you are, the farther those particles travel.
Somebody coming!
So haunted houses, they say, are a really bad idea. A haunted cornfield might be a little bit better because people are outside, but the biggest consideration here is the screaming. If people are yelling, you want to give them even more than 6 feet. That includes scary movies.
I'm calling the police!
You should never say who's there. Don't you watch scary movies? It's a death wish.
Masks can get tricky because a Halloween mask does not protect people like a well-fitted cloth mask, but the CDC also does not want you wearing both. They don't want you double layering. They say it might be too hard to breathe. They encourage costumes that make sense with a cloth mask. So expect lots of, I don't know, old-timey Western bandits. One idea that was not listed here, instead it was created by an Ohio dad, just might save Halloween: a candy chute.
I'll be having gloves or tongs and pulling out fresh candy from a freshly opened bag and dropping it down the tube.
Put a big decorated tube from your front door down the front steps at least 6 feet away. Tell the kid to put their bucket underneath, no touching, and then watch them cackle with glee as their candy arrives via slide. Just remember, don't cackle too loudly. Sorry, trick-or-treaters, I just pounded an entire bag of peanut butter cups over the last few days. I don't know what to tell you. It's really cool being a grown-up. Start here tomorrow. Remember, we don't need money from you. We don't ask for candy. We do ask for 5-star ratings and reviews on all the apps. It really does help us out. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially 4 trials facing former President Trump as he makes his 3rd bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.